Mind the gap. Please mind the gap. Anyone who has ever traveled the underground tube in London has heard this phrase or seen it posted with its famous signal of the red circle with a line across it. It's a warning. It's a warning that people gauge when something moving momentarily lines up with something that is stationary and a gap is formed. And it's a warning to not let ourselves or someone we care about it fall into or through the cracks. Mind the gap. Please mind the gap. But beyond the London Underground, this phrase became a metaphor first in the 90s to describe the gap in computer literacy forming between first and third world countries. If the first world countries were to move so fast that the third world countries would fall too far behind, a gap would form, and a gap where people and the promise of one global community may fall through the cracks, and something amazing could be lost. Mind the gap. And around 2005, this metaphor was picked up by our Unitarian Universalist denomination, where it referenced the gap that they feared was forming at the edges of our religious communities, and specifically at the edges where our young adults were ready to step off from their platforms of the community and head into the real world. And they feared that those youth would face a tumultuous time when experience was low but stakes were high and everyone's guard was down. Mind the gap, they asked. Please mind the gap. I know a little bit about what they're talking about, and I imagine some of you do too, especially if you have parented somebody through that stage. Can you remember a time back when you were first stepping out of the nest and learned something the hard way? When your innocence and inexperience was tested and there was no safety net because there was no one there to look out for you? Maybe you have a story of your first encounter with credit cards or drinking or drugs or driving a car or sex. When the thought ran through your mind, I can't believe they're really letting me do this. And it turned out that they let you because there was no one there to save you, to advise you before you took such a risk or comfort you after that risk didn't turn out so well. And you found yourself in line to graduate from the school of hard knocks before you even realized you were enrolled. How many understand what author Bruce Barton says when he comments, "Sometimes when I consider what tremendous consequences come from little things, I am inclined to believe that there are no such thing as little things." And how many had an encounter where the severity of the consequence was disproportionate to the innocence of the mistake, so much so that after you recovered, you vowed to look out for those who followed behind you. Mind the gap. Please mind the gap. These are not new epiphanies. Every community and every culture throughout history has faced the challenge about how to appropriately care for and not coddle young people as they explored their way from innocence to experience. These communities struggled to find ways to provide what we call as our mission, to provide safe places for seeking and service. In my day, when parents weren't already part of special communities with rituals of coming of age, they sent us to camp. And camp was a code word of places where many first experiences happen. Camp for me was known as a place called De Benaville Pines. It was a Universalist conference center in the Southern California mountains, and it was a place where I nervously exchanged innocence for experience. It was there I experienced my first kiss, my first crush, and my first heartbreak. By the time I was 13, my mom, who was anticipating the need for a safer place than the streets of Los Angeles where we were growing up, had become president of the board of camp, a place she knew or she hoped we could roam freely and find our own mentors and a way into a safe future. And we went there so often that I and my brother and sister came to know every square inch of that camp. We knew the pool, the lake, all the paths. We knew the craft center, and we knew where the staff cabin was. The staff cabin was where the really cool and very rebellious older kids hung out. The kids who had already discovered the allure of sex, drugs, and rock and roll. People who in most parents' vernacular were known as trouble. Those people who worked in the staff cabin in their late teens and early 20s, they all knew who I was. And so when they saw me coming, they were ready. And they took it upon themselves, knowing that this was the son of the president of the board of directors, to test my innocence and my resolve, to corrupt me if they could. And it turned out they could. Because it was there in that staff cabin that I was offered and I tried my very first comic book. But not just any comic book, mind you. It was a reprint of The Amazing Spider-Man issue number 121, the issue where the Green Goblin kills Gwen Stacy, Peter Parker's girlfriend, sending Peter into anguish and reflection, eventually revealing to all how and why he ended up becoming Spider-Man in the first place, how he acquired his power, and what he came to understand and promise to use his power for. It was the power, and specifically his promise for how to use it, that made such a strong impression on me. It wasn't that he could swing from buildings or that he had the proportionate strength and speed of a spider. It wasn't that he made sarcastic remarks as he beat up his enemies. It was discovering who Peter Parker was in the first place and the transformation that overcame his life. That underneath it all, he was exceptionally ordinary. One might even say flawed. His life was filled with problems and dilemmas, transitions, worries, loneliness, attempts to be cool, but often feeling awkward and misunderstood, just like me. And although I didn't know it at the time, just like most everybody else I knew. As I read more about Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man, I read of someone who wanted a more powerful life and who, more importantly, needed to uncover the knowledge of how to integrate that new power that he was discovering and to use it well and to use it for something besides himself. Of course, it didn't occur to me at the time how I was in that very moment in the midst of my own discovery of power and in my own time of testing. For that very day was the first day of a new camp, the day I would see a lot of my old friends and I would meet several new ones. It didn't occur to me that it was a lesson in power when my old friends carefully arranged everything so that I could stand next to Karen Salinger, the new girl at camp, during the opening fire circle, the girl that everyone could see I obviously had a big crush on. And it didn't occur to me that it had anything to do with power when I awkwardly reached out to take her hand and was desperately relieved when she did not cry out, "Oh, great mother of God, what are you doing?" But instead, she just carefully let me hold her hand. And we stood there together, side by side, and sang with everyone else at the fire circle. And then later, when she stayed behind, as the others walked off, and we shared one short, incredibly clumsy but wonderful kiss, it didn't occur to me that this was all about being bitten and discovering power. But that is exactly what I did discover. A new sense of myself and a new understanding of who I was and what I stood for, that I could be good and thought of as good, and that I could have a deeper awareness that there was something besides myself worth being good for. But goodness can be tested when there is no one to help you mind the gap. That's how it was for me and Karen. That's how it was for Peter Parker as well. Peter Parker lived his whole life in the gap. Because of a strange mix of tragedy and benevolence, he lost his parents and was raised instead by his Uncle Ben and Aunt May. And they tried to make up for the uncertainty that they knew Peter was growing up with without his parents, that they didn't keep Peter from feeling a deep loyalty to them. Peter's whole world changed on the day that he attended the science demonstration on nuclear radiation at the nearby college. A common spider dangling from the ceiling was irradiated by a particle accelerator and fell from its web and bit Peter on the hand. The bite made Peter dizzy, but it also gave him certain amazing powers: the speed and dexterity of a spider, the ability to stick to walls, and a tingling which warned him of danger. Because he was also an exceptionally bright student of science, Peter quickly developed a polymer fluid and a wrist device to shoot it that enabled him to spin webs and climb buildings and swing. And he created a costume, and voila, the amazing Spider-Man. But that was only part of the equation. That was only his power. He had yet to become a hero. He had yet to learn who besides himself really needed his power. And Jesus said to them, "You will all become deserters, for it is written, 'When they strike the shepherd, the sheep will be scattered.'" But Peter said to him, "Even though all become deserters, I will not." And Jesus said to him, "Truly, I tell you, this very night, before the cock crows twice, you will deny me three times." But again, Peter said vehemently, "Even if I must die with you, I will not deny you." And all the others said the same. That evening at the campfire, when I met Karen, I felt dizzy and powerful, and my mind raced with possibilities. We exchanged letters and loyalty and lots of conversation, some excitement and a few tears, and the courage to make promises. But at the end of the week, we parted ways. We lived about 70 miles apart, and when we returned to our regular lives, Karen and I tried to continue writing or talking on the phone, but it became clear that our opportunities to really connect would be sporadic. There was no denying in my mind that I had been bitten and that I felt different, but what would become of that difference remained to be seen. Excited by his new powers, Peter took every opportunity to explore them. He even looked for ways to use them to his advantage, and so, responding to an ad, Peter tried to make money by fighting a famous wrestler named Crusher Hogan, who he beat very easily. And the attention that he got from that match led to an appearance on a TV show, which made Peter believe that he could have a very lucrative and exciting, glamorous career. But on his way out of the studio that evening at the TV show, fate dealt him a very different hand. He was shoved aside by a criminal running from a policeman. The officer, who was far behind, called for Peter to stop the criminal, which he easily could have done, but Peter decided that it was not his problem, and the robber slipped past him and got away. It was in this time that Peter was sitting by the fire when one of the authorities came by. And when she saw Peter warming himself, she stared at him and said, "You also were with Jesus, that man from Nazareth." But he denied it, saying, "I do not know who you are talking about." And the cock crowed. The summer of that first kiss passed. Karen and I lived so far apart, and our sense of connection grew. We spent the following summer at camp together, and for a while those feelings that we originally knew returned, but another winter came, and another winter apart, and then a summer when she didn't come back to camp, and our connection grew less, and months passed, and then a year. We still exchanged letters, a couple calls now and again, but things became different. Still, I knew Karen was struggling. I knew she was having problems with her father. I read in her letters to me about her feelings of helplessness, even hopelessness. I didn't really know how to respond as a young teenager, or what to say, or what I had to offer. And the confidence that I had been gaining, the confidence that she had helped to give me, had begun taking me in other directions. And so I didn't always put as much effort as I could have into keeping that connection with her. And more time passed, and for periods, we hardly talked at all. And another, on seeing Peter by the fire, began again saying to bystanders, "This man is one of them." But again, Peter denied it. The incident with the criminal at the TV station might never have crossed Peter Parker's mind again if it weren't for what happened next. A few nights later, while at another TV appearance, a burglar broke into the home that he shared with his Aunt May and Uncle Ben, and the burglar ended up shooting Uncle Ben in order to escape. Peter returned later that night to find sirens and an ambulance outside the door. And we figured out what had happened. He became delirious with rage and vowed revenge. And so he donned his new costume and used his new powers to search the city and find the culprit. But when he finally cornered the culprit in an abandoned warehouse, he was devastated to discover that it was the same criminal who rushed past him in the TV studio just a few nights earlier. And in that moment, he came to the dreadful realization that his Uncle Ben had died because he failed to stop the man who killed him. It was my senior year in high school, and my life had become quite busy with all kinds of new loyalties that sprung from my confidence, and I came home one night to a phone call. On the phone was someone else that I knew from camp, Kathy Gillen, and after some hemming and hawing, she had begun to tell me that the day before, Karen had died in a car accident. She paused after telling me that and then added speculatively that perhaps it wasn't really an accident after all. You know how much she was struggling, didn't you? I knew. I just didn't think it was my problem until then. Then, after a little while, the bystanders again said to Peter, "Certainly you are one of them, for you are a Galilean." But he began to curse, and he swore an oath, "I do not know this man." At that moment, the cock crowed for a second time, and he remembered his promise, and he broke down and wept. Now, it's important to become clear. I don't believe, like Peter Parker did, that such an unfolding of circumstances was my fault, that I had the power to control all the feelings or the decisions of Karen or any other person. Not even superheroes like Spider-Man have that kind of control. But I am saying this. That moment in my life was and remains to this day an event which points out the difference between having power and being a hero. Power is something almost every one of us is given and possesses, but becoming a hero is about what you do with your power. Our greatest power is discovered from and channeled through relationships, and oftentimes with other people that we find in the gaps, the people who help us understand what it means to be valuable, what it means to be vulnerable, the people who took the time and took the risk to make differences in our lives, and the people who pointed out the difference that we made in theirs. The ability to make a difference in someone's life is power. But as Peter Parker discovered that night, with great power comes great responsibility. It became his motto as a superhero, and a more apt description of communities like this dedicated to love and justice I cannot imagine. Karen's memorial was held a few months after her death, and it was held at camp, the place that gave her, at least for some important moments, the sense of belonging and safety and love that she longed for, the kind of place that she needed more of in her life. And even after all the pain, the loss, the ever-awareness of the gap to which they lost their daughter, her family and friends knew that it was this community that held the power to save her life and held the power to heal theirs. They knew that the community was and always would be comprised of people who needed one another, that despite tragedies, it would remain loyal, and that at its core, it stood for a place that allowed us to weave an interdependent web of reaching out and holding on. I don't think that we always understand the importance of such places or all that we count on them for. It may be hard, but I am asking you today to imagine facing today's world without such places. If you're a parent, try imagining letting go of your children without places that teach about relationship and safety and acceptance. Try watching the people you love cross over into this dangerous world alone, seeking power they do not fully understand, navigating the consequences of living without that understanding, or the people committed to being with them as they discover it. Mind the gap. Please, mind the gap. I'm asking you this morning to remember that our world is tough on innocence. We need places that are prepared to keep an eye on what's most important to all of our well-being, which is the health of the next generation. And it will come not by teaching information, but by teaching relationship and commitment and loyalty. And it will come not simply by supporting places like this, but by compelling the next generation to build places like this. Mind the gap. Please mind the gap to the glory of life.